Welcome to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. To learn more about us and our upcoming annual conference to be held March 13th to 15th, 2025 in Harrisonburg, Virginia, visit ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Christopher Annadale, and this is another episode focused on the theme of place. Our place on this episode of The Sower is Monroe, Michigan, located on the shores of Lake Erie. And here to tell us about Monroe is Josh Bowman, the executive director of the Ciceronian Society and director of operations at All Saints Anglican Church in Holland, Michigan. Josh received his PhD from the Catholic University of America and has taught political philosophy, American politics, law, media studies at more than eight different universities. He's also well known as the former host of The Sower. Josh, welcome back to The Sower.
Thanks, Chris.
So tell us about Monroe. What makes Monroe, Michigan so special?
Yeah, thanks. You know, it's so great to talk about this. I think about how, you know, when especially my generation growing up, we're always, if you come from a small town or what you think is a small town, you either idealize it or you demonize it, right? Let's just get out of this place. And for me, it was the latter. Like, please get me out of Monroe, Michigan as fast as you possibly can. And that seemed to be the attitude of many of my classmates, especially when I graduated back in 2004 from Monroe High School. But that's not how I feel today. I think it's an immaturity that looks at that, looks at home as something to run away from. I grew up in a wonderful family, was not running from them. I have great mother and father and brother, and that was great. But Monroe, I don't think I appreciate its depth, how interesting it was. I don't think I had the facility to do so when I was younger, and as we'll probably get into here. So Monroe, let me just kind of give for those of you who don't know, if you're looking at Google Maps, go ahead and Google Monroe, Michigan. It is right there on in the southeast corner of Michigan. This is a audio podcast, so I would hold up my hand and show you, but I cannot do so. I live on the other side of the Mitt at this point. I currently live in Holland, Michigan, but Monroe is where I was born and raised. And it is the only port for the state of Michigan on Lake Erie. The rest of the ports on Lake Erie are owned by Canada or Ohio or Pennsylvania. And elsewhere. And so if you're coming from the St. Lawrence Seaway over the Erie Canal and then into Lake Erie, Lake Ontario, et cetera, it's the first place you can go. And so that made it strategically a very, very important place. And so economically, it has been important. It also has an important place in the history of the kind of the early Republic, especially in the War of 1812. And as we'll talk about later, it's the childhood home of General George Armstrong Custer, for better or worse, which is certainly a subject of jokes. It's not a big place. The city of Monroe is about 20,000. Frenchtown Township, which is the part I lived in and is a large part of Monroe County, is about another 20,000. The rest is very rural. Lots of agriculture. It's also the headquarters of Lazy Boy, who is not sponsoring this podcast, but if you'd like to do so, please give me a call. Furniture making is in the blood there. It's also in the blood of Michigan, period. Michigan is, like a lot of the Midwest, a destination for a lot of German immigrants in the 19th century, but also a lot from the Dutch, from Holland, where I live now on the west side of Michigan in Holland and Grand Rapids, very, very famous for not only its Dutch culture, but also carrying on the tradition of creating furniture. And so Lazy Boy in Southeast Michigan was a big part of that. Also, of course, in Southeast Michigan, you have the auto industry. It's hard to overstate how much that industry pervades every aspect of life in Michigan. If the auto industry suffers, everyone in Southeast Michigan suffers. That might be less true today, but not much so. I mean, so union membership is a big deal, and that personality, that union, these are union hands kind of thing, is part of it. There's also an aspect. I'm in the market for a new car right now, and when my neighbor said, "Why don't you get this Toyota or Honda or Hyundai?" they don't understand. I can't do that. It'd be an immoral affront to my family. Now, there's a lot of irrationality behind this, right? I know that a lot of Toyotas are made in the United States, and that the parts for a lot of American cars are made in other countries, as are, you know, there's Ford factories in Mexico, elsewhere, stuff, et cetera. But it's on principle, you don't buy a foreign car, right? And in Southeast Michigan, that's a big no-no. But so just lots of interesting stuff. It's special about it. It's had its ups and downs. It's gone through different times, in different moments that have challenged it, and strengthened it, weakened it. And today I think it's a place, still in search of its identity. I think, as the Ford factory moved out in early 2000s, early aughts, I think it's trying to understand, you know, what does it mean to be, from Monroe? I think is a more open question, even more so than it was when I left, 20 years ago. Wow. 20 years ago now. So yeah, that's a good place to start.
Yeah. I was going to ask, I mean, is thinking being a teenager from a small town, and I was a suburbs teenager. So I came to small town living later in my life. But, I wonder, of course, first about the difference between sort of seeing Monroe with teen eyes versus seeing, thinking about it, remembering it, maybe visiting it now, and whether there is a certain kind of way it is to be from Monroe, and if that was perhaps one of the things you were trying to escape, and if so, whether you think you succeeded.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, it's kind of like you can take the kid out of the town, but not the town out of the kid, that kind of idea. And this is very complex. Now, well, at least I think it is. As a teenager, you want to run from it because in terms of employment, there's very limited options, especially if you're someone like you and I, we focus on the life of the mind. I mean, there is a community college there, but it really wasn't a place for me. And there was, it's, if you have that more humanistic bend, it's not necessarily a place where you're going to thrive immediately. And so, you know, it made sense that I would end up in other places. I've lived now in Tennessee, Virginia, Louisiana, in Washington, D.C., Ohio, and Michigan. But at the same time, and there was also this aspect too, and I think this is still true today. You know, we at the Ciceronian Society, we love local towns. We love local culture, the small town. We celebrate it. But we would make a huge mistake, as you know, if we idealize it, right? Small towns can be places of considerable pain. This is especially true in the last, I think, the last 30 years with the epidemic of drugs. Fentanyl and opioids have been massive, massive problems, especially in Monroe. We've had a huge issue with that. Which has also contributed to crime, family breakdown, poverty, et cetera. And that was increasingly true when I was on my way out. And so there was also an aspect of trying to leave that. To use that kind of lower class poverty struggle was not as obvious to me as a kid. Coming back, I would see it more, and I have a different attitude. I mean, I think as a teen, I was like, let me just get out of it, get away from these people. But no, it's like, no, now you come back and you say, gosh, there's a lot of pain here. Because of unemployment, the struggle to move away from it, significant health issues. You know, there's been a lot of up and down with with medical care in Southeast Michigan in the last 20, 30 years. And, you know, it was so dependent, as a lot of places in Southeast Michigan were, on jobs, that it was much more susceptible to massive economic shifts in ways that I didn't see before. However, I will say this, though. One thing that's different about Monroe, Michigan, as compared to in the 20th century as compared to the 19th century, is during the Great Depression, and then especially once the New Deal stuff passed, you had FDR flooding out valleys of places in Tennessee to make the Tennessee Valley Authority. That one particular one was Norris Lake, which legend has it, I don't have proof for this, that's where the Bowman family homestead is, somewhere on the bottom of Norris Lake. And a lot of people from La Follette, Caryville, Tazewell, Tennessee, these little towns that you have to get lost to find in East, in Appalachia, A lot of those people came up to Southeast Michigan because we had not only auto factories, but we also had paper mills. And so that that was a huge source of employment when they lost their homes, they lost their jobs during the Depression. And also the Port of Monroe was important. We also had the steel factories, et cetera. A lot, you know, there's a Jeep factory in Toledo. And all these different things were employment draws. And so it grows massively in the early to mid 20th century because of that migration. And so there's also a kind of, for lack of a better word, Appalachian hillbilly redneck, as I proudly will refer to myself, in Monroe. And that aspect, when I moved to Tennessee, was very relatable. I fit right in when I went to Tennessee. It wasn't hard at all.
That's not something I'd expect to find on the shores of Lake Michigan.
No, or Lake Erie. Yeah.
Lake Erie. Sorry.
Yeah. It's on the shores of Lake, I can tell you it's on the shores of Lake Michigan too. It just looks a little different. those rednecks came from other places. But that's seeing that part of the culture as being more universal, not just a Monroe thing, I think was helpful. Also, I didn't appreciate the history at all. I just didn't have that historical sense of seeing myself as part of this much larger, older story. And I think that's a huge part of place that we miss is it's part of who we are, but it's also part of who we're becoming because we're those, whether they're wounds or benefits, we're reaping the effects of that for centuries later. And I think it's important to think through that.
You told me before that Monroe plays a certain role in the War of 1812, mm-hmm. where I imagine it's kind of sort of on the outer edge of the frontier, isn't it? In the Great Lakes.
So, you know, by the time the War of 1812 breaks out, Michigan is not a state yet. It's part of the Northwest Territory. England wants some of their land back. Native Americans want some of their land back. It's at an important juncture. You know, one of the things that's interesting is, if you're, you know, hold out your left hand, looking at the back of it, and the top there is Mackinac. At the very tip there is Mackinac Island between the two peninsulas, and Mackinac Island has a major fort. The British, I can't remember if the British built it or the French built it first. I'm guessing the French built it and the British took it over. Anyways, Americans have it at this point, Fort Michilimackinac. The British invade it. And the Americans are like, what are y'all doing? Because we didn't know there was a war. And so by the time they start moving down Michigan, they start moving down the Lake Huron shoreline, et cetera, they get to Detroit, Fort Detroit, and they take it. And so eventually the area of Monroe becomes the River Raisin battlefield. So the Raisin River is a major confluence before that goes through Monroe. It's not navigable by major boats. It's an important river, but it's commercially, it's not as massively important. It's called the River Raisin because of the French named it. It's that, you know, going back and forth, but also because there are a lot of grapes that drew on it. Also, it used to be called in an Indian language. I don't know the words, but it was referred to as it was named for the sturgeon that go up it. You know, sturgeon, an ancient fish, really cool looking. I don't think you'd ever see one in River Raisin today, but. It was known for that. The Native Americans named it that. Anyways, great farmland, great places to have villages to fish. And so everyone wants it. And this is also on the borders of what was called known as the Black Swamp. The Black Swamp is a major, major piece of land on the shores of Lake Erie, right where kind of Michigan and Ohio meet. An incredibly valuable farmland to this day for that reason. There's still it was drained, I think, at the peril of a lot of things, but also was, you know, for disease reasons and otherwise. But major swamps, some great farmland. Native Americans want it. The British, there are Native Americans on both sides, of course, in the War of 1812, but especially the Native Americans in this instance. I believe that the Potawatomi Indians was the historical land. I don't know if that's who was fighting in this case, but Tecumseh, that general who was, you know, allied with the British, was not at the Battle of River Raisin I'm not going to get the year right here. I think it's 1813. Nobody quote me on that. But eventually what happens is there's a major battle here. General Winchester's part of the story and the Americans lose. There's two battles, actually. I think it's January of 1813. And the Americans lose horribly. Now, the second battle involves a huge contingent of soldiers from Kentucky who come up. I don't think William Henry Harrison's with them, but eventually he gets over here. But and again, the Americans lose. And even after there's a bunch of wounded, there's a significant amount of there's a massacre, as it's called, the River Raisin Massacre, of individuals. It's the largest the largest amount of loss that the American military endured during the War of 1812.
Wow.
So to a point where it's going to be 5 to 6 years before the area recovers at all, because not only did they kill virtually everyone, the British and especially the Native Americans, they led some back to Detroit, which they controlled and they used as prisoners, but they burned everything. It had been a few years before that, a guy by the last name of Navarre being a very important name in Monroe, a French trader, who built the area that, so there's French trading posts. And of course the fur trade's massive in Michigan at this point. And so everyone wants control of the river there. And so, eventually they have to rebuild it, but the rallying cry among Kentucky troops and others in Indiana, Ohio, and then later out east as they finish the War of 1812, is, you know, remember the raisin. That becomes a call, because so, especially among Kentucky soldiers, they had lost so many friends and family in that. But that becomes a major point. Actually, to this day, if you go to Monroe, they have several monuments to the War of 1812, but also to that massacre, and it's the only piece of the national park system that I'm aware of that commemorates the War of 1812. And so there's a exhibit there. It's not huge, but it's really interesting. So
it's very cool. I had not realized how much of a close connection there was between Kentucky troops and mm-hmm. fighting mm-hmm. up in the Northwest Territories.
Yep. Yep. And in many ways, that's also why Tennessee was a part of the story as well, because that's where they get the name Volunteers, right? The Tennessee Vols, is they come up to help us during that time.
Let me bring us back to the present day, thinking about the current state of Monroe. And, you know, the audio industry is declining, and we might even say, you know, you and I sort of in the academic industry seems to be also declining in a certain kind of dislocation and retrenchment cycle. Mm-hmm. But thinking from the perspective of places, right, the place is still there.
Yeah.
Although the factories are gone, the jobs are gone, the fentanyl epidemic has ravaged the population. You've got changes of population as well. Some people might say, you know, one reason why a place like Monroe suffers so much is because the 20th century, the late 20th century economies of scale that came, that helped to build up Detroit and other areas as big as they were, made places like Monroe quite vulnerable to, you know, massive shifts in global trade and sort of decline, the economic decline that comes with that one reason that Monroe isn't what it used to be is that it's lost a good deal of its local sovereignty, that there really is a way in which Monroe and Monrovians perhaps are not sort of political masters of their own fate, and perhaps couldn't be in the kind of economy that they're working within, but that perhaps just sort of imaginatively imagine a sort of, you know, southeastern Michigan Napoleon of Notting Hill situation, where suddenly they get back sort of control of their destiny, of the sort of great Adam Wayne type figure to lead them. Is there, you think there's still a sort of remnant of the kind of Monroe character that might achieve a certain kind of political expression under either a sort of, you know, imaginative fantasy scenario or maybe under some more realistic scenario in our lifetimes? What do you think of that?
So, and this is true for so many communities in which they've lost their ability to control much of their own destiny. There's so many layers to that question. In the one hand, just thinking of Michigan politics, there is a significant amount of corporate welfare in the sense that, and very unaccountable. Michigan is notorious. The state of Michigan is notorious for being remarkably not transparent. This is true for Republicans and Democrats. They're terrible at it. They don't want you to look under the hood at all. And so, looking at how different companies have bought off Because what will happen in Michigan, like a lot of places, is a company will try and come in. The Goshen mess and up by Mecosta, Michigan, and Big Rapids is one example. It made international headlines. But Monroe's no different than this. You bring in a particular business or industry, people are going to fight it because it's going to close the small businesses. But it's obvious that we, the locals, don't really have much of a say in this because that major company has already bought off the politicians. Right. I mean, there's I hate to say that. It's such a cynical thing to say, but it's hard to not. It's blatantly obvious, both in Monroe and throughout the state of Michigan. And of course, Michigan's not, unusual in that sense. There's also elements that are certainly out of the state of Michigan's control, that just massive changes in agriculture have made it harder and harder to be the independent farmer at all. Right. And that there's that is its own mess in its own right. Increasingly Michigan agriculture is in the hands of fewer and fewer people. And that's a challenge. Most of the agriculture, by the way, in Southeast Michigan is corn, soybeans, and orchards, as well as wheat. But on the other side, it's berries. Here where I live, it's berries and turkey. Turkeys are a big, poultry for some reason. But berries are the big one. Cherries being up in Traverse City. Delicious Michigan cherries. You should try those. There's a little element of that. There's also an element of the union dynamic. Union life for so much of the 20th century in Michigan was massively important. It's that was just as much a part of your family for a long time as your actual family, right? I think as the unions became more partisan, specifically for the Democratic Party, that weakened it and undermined its ability to do anything. But recently they've kind of regained some leverage on some of these auto companies, but they're still limited in terms of what they can do and the weight that they pull politically. Right to work laws were passed in Michigan, but then they were repealed recently. And I think that aspect here might undermine some of in an attempt to kind of get control and get Ford, GM, Chrysler, whoever to satisfy certain demands of union workers, they've at times undermined their own economic well-being. At the same time, I don't want to diminish the fact that often I'm not anti-union personally. I think unions are a way of demanding levels of justice and fairness that are completely legitimate. To just treat me like a human person, please, CEO. And so there's an aspect of that I think is still very much part of the story in Monroe, the manufacturing history, the industrial history of we were looked over, we were ignored, people moved on from us. We don't necessarily have the same stories as you might hear from, say, some of the coal mining towns, or once the mine was done, everyone moved on. But we do have the stories of the closed factories that are just empty shells still to this day. While some of that's been cleaned up, but the paper mills, old steel mills, they tell a story of broken promises and broken dreams. And a lot of that still lives on. And so this need of recovering who we are as a town economically, culturally, I think would be, is important. I think its relationship to Lake Erie should be thought of more carefully. Its relationship to history, and to that port, I think is important. And to agriculture, I think you could revive a lot of that identity. Also, this is a big thing too. I think and I was involved in this a little bit, the wetlands of Southeast Michigan and Northern Ohio have diminished significantly in the last 200 years. Bringing those back and it being part of the ecological landscape, I think would be really important. I mean, it's a major highway for all kinds of species of birds. It's also an opportunity to do some healing, frankly. I know that sounds kind of goofy, but there's a lot of evidence of just misused land, misused water, pollution. You know, that was also a joke. Like, we'd love to fish in the River Raisin. I loved fishing in River Raisin. Don't eat anything in the River Raisin, because it may not be safe. Same thing in Lake Erie, one of the largest nuclear power plants in the country. is right there. And, you know, as well as Detroit Edison, other companies that, you know, releasing things into the water. I don't know if you can do it any other way, but at the same time, there was definitely this attitude of, where'd you catch that walleye? Which, by the way, at one point, that area of the country is known for its massive walleye population. There's walleye festivals. And there's one thing I have to say this too. This will not be for the recovery of this, of any place in the Michigan. Speaking of animals and the environment, back in the early 19th, late 18th century, so the first French explorers come through in the 1600s. I want to say the 1640s, French fur traders. They catch something called a muskrat. Chris, do you know what a muskrat is?
Tell me, please.
Okay, a muskrat is a giant drowned rat. Like, that's the best way to describe it. It's not a beaver. It's not a, it's smaller than a nutria for my Louisiana friends. But it is, it's not, I don't think it's cute. It builds like little mounds that it lives in. It lives on things in the river. Very, very prevalent there. Well, in order to satisfy Lenten commitments, French Catholics in this area, and there's a huge Catholic presence there, by the way, would eat muskrat during Lent. Chris, if you just, anyone who's listening, Google a picture of a muskrat. If you would eat this, well, I think you'd understand, like, you would want to only eat this during Lent if you're going to eat it. I've never eaten it, but they were called the muskrat French. Like, it was like a term of, like, a very specific cultural thing, that the muskrat French. I can't explain this, but if you, there's also a funny episode, by the way, if Stephen Colbert came to Monroe back in 2015, he did like a random public access show at our public access TV studios. Eminem shows up because he just drove down from Detroit to meet him. He does an interview with Eminem. And it's actually really funny. It's worth watching because he does make fun of my hometown, but in a way that I think is quite, we'll say tasteful.
I'll look it up and put it in the show notes.
Yeah, we should put that in the show notes. He also interviewed, I think one of the women who's there is a former Miss America, Kehlani Ray Rafko was her name. I doubt she'd ever listen to this podcast, but she would bring her kids to our house. I remember on Halloween. And so like when they were trick or treating, I'd be like, hey, Miss America came and got candy from my house. I don't know what year she was Miss America. It had to be in the late 70s, early 80s based on her age. So, but yeah, anyways, that's a lot of information, but a lot of goofy things that make a place what it is.
Earlier in this episode, you spoke about the kind of irrational love of place that goes with, you know, a certain kind of local pride, you know, determination not to buy foreign automobiles maybe it's probably also some element of the Ford versus GM warfare that I know from parts of the South that I've lived in. Mm-hmm. But I wonder what you think a rational love of place would look like, and whether that would involve maybe what someone might call a greater kind of realism, a more accommodation with the realities of centralized power and globalized economy.
Yeah.
What would that be like if we say not irrationally, but rationally, I love this place and I might have to love it within my own human lifetime, but also thinking about the lifetimes of my children and grandchildren. What do you say to that?
You know, it's a great point. I wonder if the dichotomy of rational versus irrational is the wrong one, where we think more about person-centric, is when you think about your participation in a local economy or in certain places, you love it because of the people that are there. I don't want to diminish the importance of a built environment or architecture or the ecological aspects of any place, but you know, you can have a physically beautiful landscape and it still not feel like a place at all because the people there aren't, you know, are just not pleasant, right? It may not be a place you want to be. So I think when I think of Monroe and I think of like a love of place, I think of very specific, whether it's a specific business, a specific family, like, hey, this family business has been here for a long time. And I just love going in there because I just feel good going in there. Or I go in there and I say, hey, it's Josh, how you doing? You know? And it does sound like that, like, hey, and kind of the Italian, because there's a, I don't know when they got there, by the way, the French were there And the Italians eventually get there, and they I think they came from the East Coast as for job reasons. But and so, like, I give an example. There's a family that owns a particular liquor store. I wasn't going in there to get liquor. I was too young. Okay, so I make sure that was all clear here. But if you go in there, the owner, who is actually now a state of Michigan legislator, I'm not going to say his name. I don't know if I have permission, and I don't want to get in trouble with the IRS here. But dude would always say, "Hey, babe," you know, everyone was babe. "Hey, babe, how you doing, babe? Oh, it's a Bowman," you know. "Oh, you look just like your dad," you know, kind of thing. That's actually a good one right there. When you have multiple generations of people in your family who have lived in the same place, and someone recognizes you as so-and-so's grandkid or so-and-so's son, or like, "Hey, how you doing? How's your family?" And they know who you're talking about. That's there's something endearing about that. You can't get it in any other place in the country, right? You can get that kind of food somewhere else. You can get that kind of economic or ecological, you know, thing. I mean, but there's only a few places where, you know, my grandpa was, his name was Jim Volpe, and he played football for the local Catholic school at the time back in the day. He's since passed on, but you know, there's still people who could tell me stories about the game that they saw Jim Volpe play in or something, or they played with Jim Volpe. "He hit me so hard," or "I hit him so hard," you know, or they'll get someone say, "You should, you know, I could tell you stories about your dad," you know, that would like, "Please don't," you know, or something, you know, things like that.
Yeah, well, you remember the episode about Ennis Montana and recognize the fella by his eyebrows.
Yeah.
If you've not listened to that one, go back and listen to that one again.
Wilsey eyebrows. Whatever he said.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know what mine, I think, is a walk. Apparently I walk like my dad. Actually, we're recording this today on his birthday.
God bless him.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's elements of that. And just like, "Are you so-and-so's uncle? Were you in that thing?" Also, you know, one of the things in my past life that, Chris, I don't know if you know about, but I did a lot of music and theater for a long time. And I thought that's where my life was headed, but it did not. And so there's also this element of, "I saw you in that show," or "I saw you sing that at that place in that event," or something. And that was important to me. Not so much to have fans, but to have that kind of community memory. One way to think of place too is a place that means something to you personally is a place where you could have small talk and it not be superficial, right? I think there's where, "Hey, we just met. Oh, you're from Monroe?" "Yeah, I'm from Monroe." "Yeah." And then you can go into like different restaurants and trials and tribulations and roads and streets. And, "Hey, did you hear that bowling alley burned down several years ago?" "Yeah, I used to grow up going there all the time." Or there actually was one of the things I've learned recently is Monroe was known for its flowers. I didn't know that, but it was at a lot of greenhouses, random. And there was a nursery that burned down a few years ago, and it was really upsetting to a lot of people, because like it had this old history. Like, "I used to go in there for no reason, just to talk, you know, talk shop, talk about farming." It was interesting dynamics. Yeah. Or you just talk about the rivalries, right, between the schools. That's always, football is just like the South, football in rural Michigan is a big deal.
Huge. Yeah.
For better or worse. And so that was always an interesting story. I think that's also what would get you to a sense of place. But one of the things, and I know you've probably encountered this too, is, you know, I've read a lot of books about place. We've talked a lot about it, the Ciceronian Society. It's very, very hard to generalize about and give yourself a theory, if you will. It's so much easier for me to talk about a specific place. It's very Aristotelian in a way. Like, it's very hard to talk about place in this, the form of place, right?
Exactly. Well, exactly.
Yeah. And I think
it's invariably
that's
particular.
Yeah. An aspect of this as well.
Before we run out of time, let me be sure to ask you about George Armstrong Custer what it's like to be from a place that maybe is associated with someone with a little bit of notoriety. What's that like? And what's the role of Custer in the history of Monroe?
You know, for better or worse, every place, not every place, but many places, there's some figure that is either notorious or famous, the home of so-and-so, right? It's on the signs when you go in and out of town.
Right.
Some, it might be a, you know, I've been, I can't remember I think it's Elgin, Illinois, which is where Reagan's from, right? I've driven through there. You get lost and you find it, that kind of thing. Or it's this famous author. No, not Monroe. Monroe, you drive in town, it's home of General George Custer. Oh boy. Somehow, despite the enthusiasm for the destruction of statues in the last 10 years, that one has survived. I don't know how, but General Custer is on a standing horse in the center of town. And it is an anatomically correct horse. The horse is male. You can imagine what teenage kids did with that. Not me, but it's just a funny aspect here. If y'all can just...
I believe you, Josh.
Deal with the levity. Okay, thank. Don't Google it. Don't Google it, Chris. Okay, anyways, so George Armstrong Custer. Now, for those, let me just kind of give a quick version here. And I'm no historian, so don't quote me here. This is not for your research paper. Born in, I think it's New Rumley, Ohio. It's a small speck of land in the Appalachian part of Ohio. When he's young, ends up moving with his family to what is now Monroe, Frenchtown Township. He spends his childhood here, his brother's here, he meets his future wife, Elizabeth, here, and he grows up in the town. I mean, I can tell you, one of the childhood homes is still actually right across, like, just down the road from where my grandma lives. It's privately owned, but there's like a historical thing in front of it. And so it's known as the home of General Custer. He would eventually leave. He'd go to a school in Ohio for a little bit. I can't remember what it's called. He eventually ends up at West Point, where he's trained, and eventually he's in the Civil War. In the Civil War, he is both notorious, but also he has moments of brilliance and bravery, if not recklessness. He is someone who he's not afraid. And so I think there was, for a long, long time, there was a lot of pride, like, because he fights for the Union, and he, which is striking. Remember, let's go back to the fact that a lot of Southerners had come up here, later on. But there wasn't that Southern personality yet. And so there's, cause the Bowman, I hate to say it on, you know, and have it published, but the Bowmans definitely fought, for the Confederacy. We have the evidence of that. Not just to be clear on this podcast, I'm not proud of that, but a lot of Monrovians, whatever you want to call us, Monroeans, they were proud of General Custer for a long time because he was brave. The number of engagements he fought in the Civil War is extraordinary. He was a brilliant cavalry officer. He's at many of the major events in the Civil War, including Gettysburg. He had met Lincoln. There's that famous picture of Lincoln. He's talking with the different soldiers in front of their tent, the different generals in front of their tents, and Custer's in that picture. Custer's there when Lee surrenders. He's very enthusiastic about battle. There's actually a time when he eventually gets injured, comes back to Monroe, starts to recover. Grant doesn't want to put him back out in the field because he thinks he's a liability, rightly so. You know, at one point he thinks about running for office. On the Democratic ticket, interestingly, because he eventually does a tour with Andrew Johnson and is friendly with Andrew Johnson. I don't know if he drinks as much as Andrew Johnson, but he's certainly in the same boat. And then eventually he's assigned to, I can't remember what the cavalry regiment is. He's still a general. He ends up in the West fighting the Indian Wars because notoriously, you know, as the country spread west, we violated treaty after treaty and went to war. Now he famously dies at the Battle of Little Bighorn, the battle where no one survived. A lot of disagreement among historians about what actually happened. And part of the thing is that there were no white men who survived to tell the tale. What we know of the battle is based on the cleanup essentially afterwards, but also talking to Native Americans, you know, years and years later. He was buried there in a shallow grave. What was left of him and his brother was then reinterred, or at least Custer was reinterred at West Point. So he's not buried in Monroe. It's a really interesting, you know, dynamic. It's not a point of where I would say I'm proud to be from the home of General Custer, because he took courage to a reckless extreme. I think in many instances, probably took it too far at times. He was not, he had an extraordinary amount of demerits, not a good student at all by his own admission. He didn't really care. Military, it's amazing he made it. He stayed that long in the military at all. I think they just needed someone who was crazy enough to do what he did. Now, whether or not the Battle of Little Bighorn was his fault is a different story. There's conflicts here because a scout goes out to see an Indian encampment and comes back and says, look, it's not that many people. Well, I mean, by the time they get there, they're outnumbered like 3 or 4 to 1. It's just an there's no chance. You know, Custer's famous last stand, as it's called, right? And so it's just Custer's last folly. And it finally cost him his death. His wife lived to be into her 90s, and she stayed. She was in Monroe for a while, and then she moved to New York City. I think New York City. But yeah, it's been interesting, right? I wouldn't cry if they took down his statue. I think I'd be upset if they took down statues of people like Navarre. I think he had a lot of courage, and he rebuilt the town after War of 1812. And so there are certain families that have done a lot that made Monroe what it is. Custer is more of a anomaly. Doesn't really represent us at all.
That's really interesting. That was not what I expected to hear when I asked you about Custer. But fascinating story, fascinating link in with history. He seems perhaps like somebody who's famous from Monroe, but yes. Not necessarily sort of Monroe or helped to make the town what it is. Did all of his work, of course, on the national stage, far away from the hometown for the most part.
Yeah. I mean, he's just in terms of his statue's the biggest one by far, but I wouldn't, if it went away tomorrow, I really wouldn't care. And I know that some, maybe our fellow conservatives might be upset. I don't think we should forget about him. I think he's an important part of our history. He's not someone that I want my kids to emulate, right? He's not someone who I think he doesn't strike me as someone who loved his country more than himself. And maybe I'm wrong. He wrote a lot. So there's a lot to be read. I mean, there's a lot of research to be done there. His wife wrote 3 biographies of him. Oh, and it, wow. And it sounds like, by the way, in my reading of it, he wanted to be a kind of Buffalo Bill, right? Where you go on these adventures and you make a living off being famous for this, right? And doing maybe sideshows later on, but he died too before he would ever do that. But I think he had that same kind of personality. He was great at playing the media, at just becoming larger than life for his own personal gain, not necessarily always for the better of the country.
Well, it sounds like we've circled back to the whole question of sort of notoriety versus virtue and this kind of Aristotelian aspect of place and then sort of this radical particularity of it. That's a good place for us to wrap up, I think. This episode of The Sower, we've been talking about Monroe, Michigan with Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Josh, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris.
If you enjoyed this episode of The Sower, please share it with a friend and rate us 5 stars. Go to our website, ciceroniansociety.org, for more information about our activities and mission.